From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Ricky Gervais, the star and co-creator of The Office, the very funny British sitcom about a mid-level office manager who thinks he's smart, witty, and a great friend to his staff, but he is not. This year, the series won 2 Golden Globes and a Peabody Award. It's shown on BBC America and is now out on DVD. Also, parenthood, suburbia, and the feeling you're living the wrong life. Tom Perrotta talks about his new novel, Little Children. When his kids were young, Perrotta was one of the few dads at the playground. He's also the author of the novel Election, which was adapted into the film of the same name. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. U.S. officials in Iraq said a ceasefire appears to be holding in the city of Fallujah, where U.S. troops have been fighting for the past week to regain control. Meanwhile, Shiite Muslim cleric Muqtada al-Sadr has apparently withdrawn his militia from parts of 3 cities in the south, although the fighters have ignored a U.S. demand that they lay down their weapons. General John Abizaid, the head of the U.S. Central Command, denounced Sadr.
A person such as Muqtada al-Sadr, who's anti-democratic and attacks the people of Iraq and their institutions, won't be tolerated.
Abizaid told reporters that he's asked the Pentagon to send 2 more brigades of troops to Iraq. The U.S. military says the U.S. and its allies have lost about 70 troops so far this month and that around 700 Iraqi rebels have been killed. President Bush said today that a classified document dated August 6, 2001, and released over the weekend by the White House, contained no information that, if acted upon, could have prevented the terrorist attacks of 9/11. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
The president defended his administration's actions in the months prior to 9/11 against allegations that al-Qaeda and terrorism were not a priority for the president at the time. Asked about a document from a month before the attacks titled "Bin Laden Determined to Strike Inside the United States," the president said it contained no specific warning.
There was nothing in there that said, you know, there's an imminent attack. There was nothing in this report to me that said, oh, by the way, we've got intelligence that says something is about to happen in America.
The president did say, however, that it might be the right time to revamp and reform U.S. intelligence services in order to better respond to future threats. Don Gagne, NPR News, The White House.
There are reports that Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon will seek to keep the largest Jewish settlement blocks in the West Bank as part of Israel's unilateral plan to separate Israel from the Palestinians. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from Israel.
News agencies quote Ariel Sharon as saying that 5 of the settlement blocks, including Kiryat Arba near Hebron and Ariel in the heart of the West Bank, will remain under Israeli control. Sharon made the remarks during a visit to the sprawling settlement east of Jerusalem, known as Male Adumim, also included on the list. Sharon also said the settlements will continue to grow stronger and develop. But freezing settlement activity is a prerequisite of the Middle East peace plan known as the roadmap. Sharon's statement apparently contradicts that plan, which President Bush has said he wants revived. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Jerusalem.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 73 points to close at 10,515 in moderate trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index gained 12 points. It closed at 2065. This is NPR News. Security officials in Saudi Arabia say police fought today with suspected militants on the outskirts of Riyadh, the Saudi capital. Officials say 1 militant and 1 policeman were killed and 5 police were wounded. Police were reported to be chasing 3 other militants. It wasn't clear who the suspects were or whether they were on the Saudi government's list of 26 most wanted terrorists. Students at a high school in rural Georgia are holding 3 separate proms for whites, blacks, and Hispanics. Organizers hope the separate events will diffuse racial tensions. Mike Savage reports from Georgia Public Broadcasting.
Students at Tubbs County High had already planned to hold separate white and black proms, but a third prom was organized for Hispanics after a student tried to purchase tickets to the white prom and was told the event was for whites and not Hispanics. Although Hispanic students make up just 12% of the 769 students at the South Georgia school, They decided to hold their own prom for May 8th, a day after the white prom. The black prom is being held 3 weeks earlier. Despite these separate off-campus events, administrators say racism is not a serious problem at the school. Most Georgia schools hold integrated proms, but a handful still hold separate proms for white and black students. Officials with the National Hispanic Advocacy Group called the separate proms in Toombs County unfortunate and sad. For NPR News, I'm Mike Savage in Atlanta.
A brief power failure shut down the air traffic control tower at Los Angeles International Airport for a time this morning, but authorities say most traffic at the airport is now back to normal. Officials say landings were postponed for about an hour, which delayed almost 100 flights. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Aveda, sponsor of environmental programming and other earth-conscious initiatives, including efforts to slow global warming. Information at aveda.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Ricky Gervais, is the co-creator and star of the hilarious sitcom The Office. Gervais plays David Brent, a mid-level office manager in a small branch of a paper company who thinks he is hip, funny, smart, a wise philosopher, and a good friend to his staff. Unfortunately, he is none of those things. He is too self-absorbed to notice that his staff constantly winces as he holds forth. Entertainment Weekly called the character the most brilliantly clueless boss on the planet. Gervais won a Golden Globe this year for Best Actor in a TV Comedy, and the series won for Best Comedy. It also won a Peabody. The show is programmed on BBC America Thursday nights and is out on DVD. Here's a scene in which Gervais, as office manager David Brent, is discussing a performance evaluation form with his receptionist, Dawn.
Okay, if you had to name a role model, someone who's influenced you, who'd it be?
What, like a historical person?
No, someone in sort of general life, just someone who's been an influence on you.
Well, I suppose my mum. She's strong, calm in the face of adversity. God, I remember when she had a hysterectomy.
If it wasn't your mother, though. I mean, it doesn't even have to be a woman. It could be a...
Man. Okay, well, I suppose if it was a man, it'd be my father.
Not your father. I mean,
no.
Let's take your parents as red. I'm looking for someone in the sort of work-related arena.
Right.
Influence.
Okay, well, I suppose Tim, then, he's always...
Well, he's a friend, isn't he? Not a friend. Someone in authority. Maybe I didn't, you know...
Well, then I suppose Jennifer.
I thought you said not a woman, didn't we? Or am I...
Okay. Well, I suppose you're the only one who...
Oh. Embarrassing. That's backfire, isn't it? Oh, dear. Very flattering. Can we put me? I don't know.
Okay, Tim, then.
Well, we said not Tim. So, do you want to put me or not?
Okay.
Right. So, shall I put strong role model?
Okay.
Yeah.
I love the distance between what the character thinks of himself and what he's really like.
Well, the blind spot is one of my favorite things. I mean, in life and comedy, I think it's funny and it's tragic. The way he talks about everyone loving him, that's a strange thing to say. To wear your popularity on a sleeve. He's one of those people that would rather hand out sort of business cards than bother getting to know people. He wants to say, David Brent, great bloke, you'll love me, I'll like you in return. Pretension has always interested me. I love pretension. Vanity might be my favourite. So you put that in a man and you put it in a 40-year-old man and you put it in a 40-year-old man who thinks he's the funniest, most popular man in the world. And you can't go wrong, really.
Some of my favorite shots in The Office are the cutaways to the people who work in the office. And every time David Brent is like telling a joke or describing what a great boss he is or, you know, how funny he is, everybody's like averting their eyes and looking at their shoes or staring at the wall or just like...
comedy's contextual. I mean, the funniest things in The Office aren't the people who are actually funny. They're the people who aren't funny. It's the faux pas, it's the failure that's amusing. I learned a lot from Laurel and Hardy. The funny thing wasn't Stan saying something stupid, it was the cut to Ollie, who then looked at him like he was the worst person in the world, and then he looked at us as if to say, why am I with this idiot? When Brent tells a bad joke, it's the fact that it goes to other people not laughing.
Now, you've created this story about life in an office. Have you ever worked in an office?
Yeah.
You
I
did?
Worked in an office for 8 years. That's where I got it all from. I was a middle manager. I went to management training seminars where those speakers talked rubbish for 2 days. yeah, I worked in an office for 7 or 8 years.
What kind of office was it?
The office in the series is based on the office I worked in. We actually shot the demo in my old office, that very generic open plan thing. I worked around reception for a while. Then I was a publicity officer. Then I was assistant events manager. Then I was events manager for about 5 years. It was all going in.
So where was this?
This was at the University of London Union in London.
Are any of the storylines in The Office based on things that have happened to you?
Oh, let me think. Let's see. Episode 4, it's series 1, where we had the guy come in to train people. I remember the first training session I went to, it was held by some other managers when I was just, I think I was on reception, and they weren't really trained for it. And I remember they did role play, and I remember at the time thinking, this is ridiculous, because they sort of divvied it up between them, and they said, okay, I'm going to play a bad hotel manager, you play the customer. And it started off, I'd like to complain about my room. Oh, well, I don't care. Well, you should, you're the manager. Well, go to another hotel then. Well, I will. And they went, that's the wrong way to do it. And then they said, okay, now we'll do it the right way to do it. And he comes in and says, oh, I'd like to complain about my room. Oh, I'm very sorry, sir. What's up with it? Oh, it's just dirty. Oh, well, I'll have someone clean it and you can have it for free. Brilliant. It was like as black and white as that. And I remember thinking, I don't know what the moral is. So I quite like spoofing role play.
Why don't we hear that scene? In the scene, David Brent is role playing with the guy who's running the seminar, and David Brent is supposed to be playing the customer, and the guy running the seminar is the hotel clerk.
I'd like to make a complaint, please.
Don't care.
Well, I am staying in the hotel.
I don't care, so it's not my shift.
Well, you're an ambassador for the hotel.
I don't care.
I think you'll care when I tell you what the complaint is. I think there's been a rape up there. I got his attention. Get their attention. Okay?
Right, so, well, some interesting points.
Very interesting points.
Flagged up there. It's not quite the point I was trying to make.
Different points to be made.
I'm more interested really in customer care.
So am I.
And the way that we would deal with somebody.
I should play the hotel manager because I'm used to that. I phased you. But you have a go. See if you can phase me, OK?
Hello. I wish to make a complaint.
Not interested.
My room is an absolute disgrace.
Don't care.
The bathroom doesn't appear to have been cleaned.
What room are you in?
362.
There is no 362 in this hotel. Sometimes the complaints will be false. OK? Good.
David completely misses the point in that, but that's so typical of him.
Of course, because he wants to be top dog. He wants to be the centre of attention. He couldn't, he hires this guy, but then he wants to be in charge. So he's just a child. You know, it's his football, and he's got to be, the most important player.
Now, later in this same seminar, David turns the discussion into basically a Q&A about himself. And then he reveals he used to be in a band, and then he takes out his guitar and he starts playing some songs.
Awful,
exactly. In fact, let me play some of the songs.
A spaceman came down to answer some things. The world gathered round from paupers to kings. I'll answer your questions, I'll answer them true. I'll show you the way, you know what to do. Who is wrong and who is right? Yellow, brown, black or white? The spaceman, he answered, you no longer mind. I've opened your eyes, you're now colorblind. Racial. So, she's the serpent who guards the gates of hell. Pretty girl on the hood of a Cadillac, yeah. Broken down on Freeway 9.
Take a look, get her engine started, leave a purr and then I roll on by, bye bye. Free love on the free love freeway. The love is free and the freeway's long. I got some hot love on the hot love highway. Ain't going home cause my baby's gone.
She's dead.
She's not dead. Long time later, see her. Cowboy crying, says, hey buddy, what can I do? Says, I lived a good life, about 1,000 women. I said, well, why the tears? He says, because none of them was you.
What, you?
No, he's looking at a photograph.
Of you?
No, of his girlfriend. The video would have shown up.
Yeah, he sounds a bit gay at the moment.
It's not gay.
No.
Free love on the free love freeway. The love is free.
That's Ricky Gervais as David Brent in a scene from the British sitcom The Office, which is on BBC America and is also now on DVD. Now, Ricky, I know you used to be in a band. Are any of these songs you used to do for real?
No.
Good. I was really hoping you'd say that.
No, of course not. No, I wrote those especially for the show. And they weren't spoof songs. They were meant to be sort of like more inappropriate. Free Love Freeway. I'm fascinated when... British people who've never been out of their own town start writing songs about what it would be like to cross America. You know, they might as well talk about space travel. And I just thought it was, the joke there wasn't that he was bad or the songs were comical. It was the fact that it was so inappropriate. He's meant to be leading a training session, but he wants to show off. And I love that. Same as those people who take a guitar to a party. I just want to go, what are you doing? You know, it's just like, shut up. I just found it amusing that, again, a 40-year-old man who's meant to be doing something about customer care just wants to talk about being Bruce Springsteen.
The other great thing about this scene is that he does all these horrible things that make you so uncomfortable when a bad performer is singing in a small room. He looks people in the eyes in kind of dreamy way. And
excruciating, isn't it?
Exactly.
Absolutely excruciating. The white man overbite. To show he's really getting into it.
Yes, he bites his lip to show how sensitive he's being.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, as a musician yourself, is this something that you've done or that you've just...
I'll stop you there. Failed musician. Let's get it right.
Okay, that's fine. is this something that you fear you've done yourself?
Failed musician, I'll have you know.
So is this...
I hope I was never like that.
But you've seen people that be that way.
And I wasn't 40. So I hope there's enough distance between... me and David Brent there.
My guest is Ricky Gervais, the co-creator and star of the British sitcom The Office. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Ricky Gervais, co-creator and star of the British sitcom The Office. The Office is shot as a mock documentary because, you know, we're not only seeing the scenes in The Office, there are scenes in which the individual characters are talking one-on-one behind the scenes with the camera, sharing their insights into The Office and their opinions of themselves and their personal philosophies. Why did you want to shoot it as a mock documentary?
Well... that sort of seemed the most obvious way to shoot it for a few reasons. One, we'd come out of in England, come out of about 5 years where docu-soaps were like the biggest thing on television. Normal people being followed around at work, and there was one called Hotel, one called Airport, and if you shoot like 10 people in a job, one of them's usually the character. And they were getting a bit famous. They were getting their Andy Warhol 15 minutes. And I was fascinated by that. That celebrity, that D-list celebrity, people's just a quest for fame on any level. I've always been fascinated with why people just want to be famous. You speak to people and they go, I want to be famous. And you say, as what? They go, it doesn't matter. And I've never understood that. And I thought the best way to shoot it would be with their consent. So if it was a closed narrative and this guy was going around, you'd think, well, why is he acting like that? But because the camera's there, you go, oh, I get it. He thinks he's brilliant. He thinks the camera's his friend, and he doesn't learn. You know, if he just sat down and said, "Let get the cameras out of here," life would be okay. But because he thinks this is his salvation, it's so much worse. So that's why, really, it just wrung out the awful, cringeworthy nature of the whole thing. And particularly when he looks down the lens at you, you suddenly go, "Oh God, he's looking at me," and it makes it even more awful to watch, because it suddenly draws you in. Because embarrassment is sort of is catching. If someone embarrassed themselves, you're sort of embarrassed as well.
I've got to get in another scene here, and this is a scene from the second season of The Office, which is now out on DVD. And in this season, two branches of this paper office have merged so that there are new people in David Brent's office now. And the manager from the second office is now David Brent's boss, but David Brent is still overseeing, you know, some of the new people who have come in. And, you know, he thinks he's so funny, and he's been telling this, like, off-color joke about the virility of black men. And a lot of people have been really offended by it. They've complained to his boss. So here he is with the new people on the staff trying to explain himself.
Now, some of you maybe didn't understand the jokes I was making and misinterpreted one and went to Jennifer. Okay. Little bit annoyed that you thought you'd go to Jennifer and not me. Who was it that complained? And it's not a witch hunt, just who was it that... Okay, well, two of you. Good. Right, you. Why did you think you'd go to Jennifer but not me?
Because I don't know you, and I didn't like the kind of joke you were telling.
Wow.
And I don't think somebody in your position should be laughing at black people.
It's funny that only two of you thought that out of everyone, but, you know, everyone's...
I didn't like it either.
Right, proves my point. Swindon. You're new, you don't know me.
I'm not new, and I found it quite offensive.
Right, well, he didn't.
But
so
what's he got to do with it?
Well, if he doesn't mind us laughing at him, what harm's been done is what...
But why is it that only black people should be offended by racism?
Good point, yeah? First sensible thing you've said all day, yeah? Because I say, come one, come all, we're all the same, yeah? Let's...
So is that why you've only got one black guy in the whole organisation?
Wrong, yeah? Indian fella in the warehouse. And there used to be one... Indian fella used to work up here. Lovely chap, he left, didn't like it. Up to him, you know. If I had my way, the place would be full of them. Wouldn't it, Gareth?
Yeah, well, half and half.
Yeah. You are half and half, aren't you?
Mixed race, yes.
Yeah. That is my favourite, yeah? That is what I'm trying to... That's the melting pot, please. So, there's your racist for you.
That's a scene from The Office, season 2. My guest is Ricky Gervais, who plays David Brent and co-created the series. Ricky Gervais, I love that scene. He's just doing absolutely everything wrong, as if telling the joke wasn't problem enough. He just keeps getting himself deeper and deeper, and he has no idea what's wrong with anything that he says. And I'm wondering what kind of situations you've seen like this.
The thing is, another theme about it is obviously men as boys, boredom, underachievement, wasting your life. But one of the other scenes is those people who know what political correctness is. And, you know, David Brent isn't a racist. He isn't a homophobe. He isn't particularly sexist. But to make sure you know he isn't, he acts inappropriately over the top. He goes too far. You know, if he just acted normally, no one would accuse him of any of those things. But he wants to overcompensate. Like when the black guy comes, he every chance he gets, he sidles up to him and says things like, "Oh, Denzel Washington's good, isn't he?" And the guy goes, "Yeah, he goes, not my favourite though. My favourite actor of all time is Sidney Poitier." And of course, he's just trying to get in black references. He wants to go up to him and go, "I'm not a racist. I'm not a racist." And it's just he doesn't know how to behave.
You created this character of David Brent for a short that Stephen Merchant, your co-creator on the series, was filming. So was this a character that you were already doing before you even did that short film?
It was a character I already had. And then Stephen said that would make a good character for a sitcom, basically. And so we shot a little demo of the office. We went back to where I used to work in my old office, and I sort of ad-libbed around David Brent, and we got 20 minutes out of it in about a day, and we cut it together, and just to see how it would look, and that's what we showed to the BBC.
How did you first start performing?
Sort of by accident. I was the head of speech at a local radio station.
Does that mean like head of talk programming, head of speech?
Exactly. Uh-huh. Yeah. And I started popping up on air, just doing bits and pieces. And, you know, got a few emails saying, he's a funny guy, who's that? And they gave my own show. And then when I was doing my own show, someone from Channel 4 phoned and said, we're starting this new thing, do you want to do an audition? And I did the 11 o'clock show. So it all sort of started from there, really.
Can you describe what your radio show was like?
What was it like? It wasn't like any other radio show. I don't consider myself a broadcaster. I don't really think I'm that articulate. I'm lazy. I barely open my mouth when I talk. I'm not very good at DJing. So that gives you some idea.
Sounds great.
It was a couple of blokes in a room talking like we did in the pub, as opposed to going, it's fast approaching 9:23. Coming up is Radiohead. Those guys are great. And when I first started, I sort of I opened the mic for the first time and I went, and that's David Bowie. And my mate said, why are you talking like that? I went, I don't know. And then I just sort of put my feet up and started talking normally.
You have a couple of comedy shows that you've done, stand-up. One called Animals and one called Politics. Tell us about Politics. Are you actually political in it?
The joke is that I pretend to be. I come out like I'm going to try and change people's attitudes. And, of course, I get everything wrong. For example, when I talk about Nelson Mandela, I say Nelson Mandela, incarcerated for a quarter of a century, came out in 1990. So he's been out for about 14 years. And he hasn't reoffended. I really think he's going straight this time, which shows you prison does work.
That's really funny.
So it's stuff like that.
So you kind of specialize in people who are incomprehending.
Well, yeah. The jokes, I think the important thing is the joke's always got to be me, however subtle that is or obvious. I think at the end of the day, a comedian's got to be the target. Otherwise, he's cool and he's vain and he's less funny.
Well, Ricky Gervais, a pleasure to meet you. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Ricky Gervais stars in The Office. It's shown on BBC America and is now on DVD. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Going home, 'cause my baby's gone, she's gone, yeah. My baby's gone, she's gone, yeah. Gone away, she's gone, yeah. She's just gone away.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Whisker of Evil, A Mrs. Murphy Mystery by Rita Mae Brown and Sneaky Pie Brown, authors of The Tale of the Tip-Off. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Tom Perata talks about his new novel, Little Children, about a young wife raising her child in the suburbs, convinced she is living the wrong life. Perata also wrote the novel Election, which was adapted into the film of the same name. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Little Children is a new satirical novel about a young woman who is married, raising her child in an upper-middle-class suburb, and she can't understand how she wound up in the life she's living. She believes she's found some larger drama and meaning in her life when she meets Todd, a father at the playground who seems to be as alienated as she is. They begin an affair and think they're falling in love. The author of Little Children is Tom Perata, who also wrote Election, a satirical novel about a high school election, which was adapted into a film starring Matthew Broderick and Reese Witherspoon. Perata's novel The Wishbones was about a musician who wants to be a rock star but is stuck playing weddings. In the New York Times book review of Little Children, Will Blythe wrote, "Little Children is an extraordinary novel about adultery and child raising in a generic American suburb." Here's a reading from the beginning of the novel.
The young mothers were telling each other how tired they were. This was one of their favorite topics, along with the eating, sleeping, and defecating habits of their offspring, the merits of certain local nursery schools, and the difficulty of sticking to an exercise routine. Smiling politely to mask a familiar feeling of desperation, Sarah reminded herself to think like an anthropologist. I'm a researcher studying the behavior of boring suburban women. I am not a boring suburban woman myself. Jerry and I started watching that Jim Carrey movie the other night. This was Cheryl, mother of Christian, a husky 3.5-year-old who swaggered around the playground like a mafia chieftain, shooting the younger children with any object that could plausibly stand in as a gun, a straw, a half-eaten banana, even a Barbie doll that had been abandoned in the sandbox. Sarah despised the boy and found it hard to look his mother in the eye. "The pet guy?" inquired Marianne, mother of Troy and Isabel. "I don't get it. Since when did passing gas become so hilarious?" Only since there was human life on Earth, Sarah thought, wishing she had the guts to say it out loud. Marianne was one of those depressing supermoms, a tiny, elaborately made-up woman who dressed in spandex workout clothes, drove an SUV the size of a UPS van, and listened to conservative talk radio all day. No matter how many hints Sarah dropped to the contrary, Marianne refused to believe that any of the other mothers thought any less of Rush Limbaugh or any more of Hillary Clinton than she did. Every day, Sarah came to the playground determined to set her straight, and every day she chickened out.
That's Tom Perata reading from his new novel, Little Children. Tom, the main characters in this novel are kind of living the wrong life. Like Sarah, the main character who you were just reading about. This is not the life she wanted. She didn't plan on being a mother living in the suburbs. In college, she had been bisexual. She had an affair with a woman. She was immersed in critical gender studies. She worked at a rape crisis hotline. She was hoping to be a feminist film critic. I think a lot of people feel that they ended up in the wrong life. How did she get there?
Well, I think she got there the way a lot of people get where they end up. The years after college were particularly lonely for her. She was directionless. She tried graduate school, was very excited for a while, but then didn't like teaching very much, worked at Starbucks, had some affairs. And somehow there was a man at Starbucks, an older guy who was also a little bit lost, who found his way toward her. And, you know, they fell in love, so she thought, got married, and suddenly found herself in the exact, I mean, she didn't have a profession. He did. Basically, there's a kind of economic determinism to it that's almost 19th century to her. I also think there's something about the generation, that's my generation, the people who went to college in the 80s and 90s, when feminism was still, I think, a really dynamic force in American culture. And you know, we, in our minds, imagined a whole different set of social arrangements and family arrangements, and something happened, you know. I mean, when I was first a parent and at the playground, I was suddenly surprised to find myself often the only stay-at-home dad. I wasn't a full-time stay-at-home dad, but I was doing about half-time childcare, and if I took my kids to the playground during the workday, I was usually the only man there. And I think that in the same way that I probably felt surprised by that and a little bit you know, like what had happened? What where was the world that we thought we were entering? I think someone like Sarah, who was, you know, really in the vanguard of this sort of thinking, probably felt it quite a bit more acutely than I did.
Well, I want to get back in a minute to you being the only dad in the playground, but first I want to talk about another father, a father in your novel, who is the father in the playground. He's one of the few guys who goes there with his kids, with his kid, and he ends up having an affair with Sarah. But he, too, feels like he's not quite in the right life. His thing when he was in college was football, and now he's studying for the bar exam kind of unenthusiastically. How did he get stuck in the wrong life?
Well, he's not sure about that. His mother died when he was in high school, and he'd become a sort of high achiever in the wake of that. And life had been completely effortless for him through. He's a very good-looking guy, very smart guy. He married this beautiful woman. He got accepted into law school. And at some point, between finishing law school and passing the bar, you know, they had a kid. His wife was working full-time. He was home with the kid. And what seemed to happen to Todd was that he just lost interest in the adult trajectory that he'd been on. I mean, in some ways, he's a male version of one of those women CEOs who suddenly decides that she doesn't want to, you know, run the company. She wants to be home with her kids. In some sense, parenthood does appeal to him. I mean, in a way, his wrong life is the exact opposite wrong life of Sarah's. I mean, he's a man who's supposed to have a high-powered career who somehow has decided he likes the rhythms of being home with a kid all day and likes the rhythms of adolescence, likes the rhythms of sports. He likes everything but the rhythms of responsible adulthood.
Do you feel like you're living the right life?
I feel like I am now. I think that I was one of those people who was very shaken by parenthood. Not so much because I didn't like it, because I really did enjoy it, and I found it kind of thrilling and mesmerizing the way a lot of people of my generation, you know, do. At the same time, I wasn't where I wanted to be professionally, and you know, I was shocked by the time burdens that were placed on me, and you know, I had gone to great lengths to, you know, invent myself as somebody who, you know, at a certain level of coolness, or so I thought, you know, and I think parenthood is about the least cool role you can take on. And so for anybody who has any sort of, I think, you know, bohemian leanings or aspirations or self-delusions, you know, you can put it in all those ways, parenthood is a jolt to, you know, the very fiber of your being.
I'm sure that's true. And why is that? What is it that is so, like, uncool about parenthood? Unhip about parenthood?
Well, for one thing, right, coolness must have something to do with a kind of, I mean, there's a certain sexual component to it, and mm-hmm. as a parent, you know, your sexuality is, I think, you know, for good reasons, you know, it goes on the back burner, you know, probably even at home, but certainly in a kind of public way. But then it's, you know, you have to argue with your kids. You have to, you know, try and mollify them when they're screaming. You have to walk around with, you know, vomit on your shirt. In fact, you know, one of the roots of this novel was a strange event that happened to me when my daughter was very young, and I used to carry her around in a backpack, which I really enjoyed. But one night I was out for a walk with her, and this guy was a teenager. Just started taunting me from a doorway. He just would call me, you know, say, "Hey, you look like an idiot," or something like that. And I remember getting, like, you know, oddly enraged and sort of forgetting for a second that I had my daughter on my back. And, you know, I turned and I said, "You know, who are you talking to?" And, you know, we had this sort of odd, heated exchange, which is not something that's common in my life. And at a certain point, he just started laughing. He said, "What are you gonna do, fight me with that thing on your back?" You know, that thing on my back being my daughter.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, what's the matter with me? Why am I acting like an angry 16-year-old when I'm, you know, 30 years old and I have a small child on my back? And it was just a moment that really stuck with me. And about 10 years ago, I tried to write a story that was called This Thing on My Back, that was about, you know, somebody kind of very reluctant, well, not, it's not even reluctantly, just somebody finding out that his, you know, adolescent identity was still burning inside of him while he was, you know, a responsible adult with a child to care for.
How old are your children now?
My daughter's 10 and my son is 7.
In the acknowledgments to your new novel, Little Children, you end it by saying, mainly, though, I'd like to thank Nina and Luke for letting me tag along at the playground. So I assume that Nina and Luke are your children, and that you spent a lot of time taking them to the playground and using that as inadvertent research for your novel. You have a really funny paragraph about what the few men who come to the playground with their children are like, what they look like, and how they behave. I'm going to ask you to read that paragraph for us from Little Children.
Okay. Most of the men who showed up at the playground during the workday were marginal types, middle-aged trolls with beards and pot bellies, studiously whimsical academics who insisted on going down the slide with their kids, pinch-hitting grandfathers providing emergency daycare, sheepish blue-collar guys who wouldn't meet anyone's eyes, the occasional cooler-than-thou hipster with a flexible schedule.
Were you the occasional cooler-than-thou hipster with a flexible schedule?
I was somewhere between the hipster with a flexible schedule and the studiously whimsical academic. But there was some part of me that was also a sheepish blue-collar guy who wouldn't meet anyone's eyes.
All right. What was it like to be one of the few fathers regularly at the playground with your children?
Some women who were at the playground would deny this, but I was actually, I thought, made to feel somewhat unwelcome. There was just some sense of, you know, what is he doing here? And if you try to strike up a conversation, sometimes there was a little bit of reserve or coolness. But what did happen, and I think is something I tried to use in the novel, was that occasionally there would be a woman who, for some other reason, was not part of, you know, the sort of the core female society of the core mother group of the playground, and occasionally I would get into conversations with these women who, for whatever reasons, were also outsiders, and that's the dynamic, I think, between Todd and Sarah. They both feel somehow excluded from this core maternal clique at the playground, and it creates a kind of instant bond of intimacy between them.
My guest is Tom Perata. His new novel is called Little Children. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tom Perata, author of Election and The Wishbones. His new novel, Little Children, is a satirical novel about a woman, Sarah, who once thought she'd be a feminist film critic and is now feeling quite alienated as a wife and mother in the suburbs. She's attracted to a young father named Todd, who she met at the playground. There's a section in which Sarah goes shopping for a bathing suit, and she wants to get a bathing suit that makes her look really attractive. Which was difficult, and I think most women agree that buying a good bathing suit is a real challenge, and it's something a lot of women are particularly self-conscious about. What kind of thinking did you do to try to write that scene from a woman's perspective?
I think for men, it's very interesting. You know, the point where you realize how you know. Nervous and anxious women get about these things, because of course for most men I think the idea of a woman in a bathing suit is you know, kind of a very exciting thing, and you know, the fact is women are probably much harder on themselves and their bodies than men are at a certain point, so I think that, again, it seems like a pretty pervasive thing. I mean, I read some catalogs, you know, and for instance, if you read, you know, the Land's End catalog, there's a very kind of, you know, the voice of the catalog is, you know, this is coverage. This is going to, you know, save you from certain embarrassing issues that will conceal the problem areas. I mean, it was really just right there in the forefront. And maybe, you know, what I was reading, something that men don't normally pay attention to. You know, we're just supposed to look at the pictures. But it was, you know, right out in the front, you know. And I've certainly heard women, you know, talk about the bathing suit dilemma.
Do you want to read that paragraph?
Sure.
In this paragraph, Sarah is shopping with her young daughter, Lucy, and while she's, you know, trying to find a good bathing suit, she also has to keep track of where her daughter is.
That's right. And I should say that Sarah is hoping to go to the town pool and reconnect with Todd after their first intense flirtation. So she's given this a lot of thought. When she finally made her selections, she dragged Lucy into the fitting room and told her to stay put while she tried the suits on over her generously cut gray cotton panties, which kept poking out and spoiling the effect. Not that there was much to spoil. The first suit hugged her hips and waist perfectly, but looked about three sizes too big on top. The second fit nicely across her chest, but drooped off her ass like a tote bag. She thought the third suit looked okay. It was a black one-piece, daringly low-cut, with a series of oval cutouts traveling up the side. But when she left the fitting room to consult with the sales lady in front of the three-way mirror, the woman hesitated for a long time before answering. "I wouldn't," she said finally.
Yeah, I love that. You know, when you know, like when the sales lady who needs to sell you clothes thinks something looks bad, it really looks bad.
I know. Usually she'd say she would.
That was good. Okay. Thanks for reading that. Did you talk with your wife a lot about certain things, you know, before writing the book or while writing the book, just to get, you know, just again to get into a kind of female point of view of things?
I think when you live with somebody, you get their point of view.
Good point.
Kind of around the clock. I'm sure I had to ask her certain questions, and she'd be very happy to help me if I did. But I think it's more like, you know, a steady stream of information that I get from her and from, you know, other women friends.
You refer to Madame Bovary a lot in the book, and in fact, Sarah's reading group is reading Madame Bovary. Did you reread Madame Bovary before writing Little Children?
I did, yeah.
And, you know, for Sarah, she finds it is a very different book than the book she remembers reading when she was younger. She's identifying with it in a different way and seeing meaning in it that she didn't see the first time around. Did it read differently to you than it did the first time around?
Well, I was certainly reading it through her eyes, and I think, you know, her journey kind of reflected my own, or my journey reflected hers. I mean, to read a lot of novels in an academic context in the mid to late 80s, early 90s, meant that you got a kind of, often got a feminist interpretation, particularly a novel like Madame Bovary, where, you know, a previous generation would have talked about it on the level of craft and style and you know, Flaubert's doctrines of the novel. I think a lot of us read it through a kind of feminist lens of, here's a woman who, for all sorts of cultural and economic reasons, you know, is trapped and has this one means to rebel, but even that is a kind of, you know, doesn't give her any room, and you know, she suffocates despite her best efforts to rebel against this, you know, oppressive society. Whereas Sarah, you know, would have been the first one to have, you know, approved of that reading. She'd been a critical gender studies major and speaks a lot about her teachers and their thoughts about phallocentrism and, you know, male domination of the culture. But instead, her second time around, she's reading it as if she were Madame Bovary. She's completely identifying with the character. And her reading of it, in the end, is not that Madame Bovary was wrong to want some love to save her from the tedium of her life. She just didn't find a partner worthy of that passion. And Sarah, for a brief moment, thinks she has found a partner worthy of that passion, and that partner's Todd.
My guest is Tom Perata. His new novel is called Little Children. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
My guest is Tom Perata. His new novel, Little Children, is a satire about marriage and parenthood in the suburbs. You've written about different stages of life, from high school and election to college to young adulthood, young parenthood. Do you think that your writing style has changed when telling stories of people of different ages?
I'm not sure what to attribute that to, but I looked back at Bad Haircut recently, which is a book that means a lot to me. I wrote it when I started when I was in my late 20s.
It's a collection of short stories.
Short stories, all about a boy growing up. It's like almost like snapshots of this boy from age 8 to age 18. And occasionally I'll read it in public, or I'll go back and look at it. And the style is very different from the style in this book. It's much more kind of Hemingway-esque or Carver-esque. The sentences are very short, very clipped. There's not a whole lot of, internal monologue for the main character. Even though it's done in first person, it's done in that minimalist style of, here's what happened, here's what someone said. And there's a lot of irony generated by, the way that the sort of bare bones of the story are juxtaposed. But the style is a lot more sort of choppy and less fluid and less internal than what you get in Little Children. And, I might say that that's because, these older characters have richer inner lives and I couldn't write about them in the same way. That's one possible answer. And the other is just that, that minimalist voice, which I really admired and loved in Carver and Hemingway, wasn't completely mine, and that now I'm beginning to grow into a voice that's a little more my own.
You've said that one of your interests is, writing in a period that's obsessed with youth culture. And you started writing when you were in your 20s. You started publishing, I should say, yes, when you were in your 20s?
30s? I started writing those stories when I was in my 20s, but they didn't get published till I was in my early 30s. Bad Haircut.
Has it been difficult for you to make that transition out of youth culture as a writer and as a person, to not be like the young person anymore or the young writer?
No, I just practice denial on an extreme level.
I guess I'm wondering, what's your approach to getting older in a culture that is so kind of youth obsessed and so in denial about getting older?
I think a lot of people my age, there is that kind of denial. I mean, I know that when my first kid was born, one of the first things I did was get a mountain bike and had some some period, where I think I take way better care of my body now and spend a lot more time exercising now than I did when I was young. And I was, at least until a couple of years ago, I was the kind of person who, I would still get carded. And, when I'd go take out books from the library at the college where I taught, they'd say, oh, you're not a student. But recently I've started to go gray and I don't get that anymore. I'm trying to do it with some combination of, grace and defiance, as for the writing, I have to say that I'm still a little bit 10 years behind. I mean, I'm in my early 40s, but the characters in Little Children are in their early 30s. I do think I'm still looking backwards and trying to figure out, what it is that I've gone through. And that seems okay for a writer to look backwards in that sense.
Are you wondering what it's going to be like to watch your kids go through the periods in life that you've already written about? And you'll be in the position of parental authority figure.
I do wonder about that. My hope is just that, I really do think I grew up, I was in high school in the mid-70s. I think at the time of, just really the deepest, it's probably a hangover from that deep generation gap of the 60s. I think, it seems much easier for parents to be close to their kids and to feel like they're on the same cultural page with them right now than when I was younger. So I'm hoping in a way that the kind of difficulties that I went through with my parents, which were just garden variety, they didn't, understand why I wore my hair the way I did, what kind of clothes I wore, the music I listened to, and there were just a lot of kind of superficial clashes. Whereas, you know, now it seems to me that it's easier for kids to be close to their parents. In fact, some friend of mine who's a dean at a college was saying that a lot more parents come and, you know, stay with their kids, you know, in their room in college. You know, one mother would come every weekend and sleep on the couch, and it was all right with all the roommates. And I'm not saying I'm going to be that kind of father. I just mean that I think there's a little bit less that sense of parents as a kind of unwelcome alien intrusion into the world of kids. But maybe I'm being very optimistic because I don't want to, you know, be on the wrong end of that divide.
Well, Tom Perotta, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, well, thanks for having me, Terry. I enjoyed it.
Tom Perotta's new novel is called Little Children. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillock, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Barnes & Noble Classics, enduring works of literature in newly annotated editions, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Aveda, an earth-conscious beauty company committed to preserving natural resources and finding more sustainable ways of doing business. Information available at aveda.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio. The American-led coalition in Iraq is facing Sunni and Shiite insurgencies. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Juan Cole, a professor of history at the University of Michigan and an expert on modern Islamic movements. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.